Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Diagnosing a Killer. I'm Coel.
And I'm Kenna.
Hello.
How are we doing?
How's it going?
Ugh. Light.
Oh my gosh. Ugh.
I know I'm gonna sound like a fucking broken record, but 9 days until we go to Alaska!
Sorry. When you guys go to Alaska, I'll be here working.
Hey, but we're gonna have all the content for you guys, and we are going to have a doozy of a case that will take us through that vacation. So even though I will not be here, you will still hear us talking.
Yes,
but today is your case, before we get into that doozy, and I am anxious to hear what you have.
Before we get started, would you like to give everyone our handles?
Sure. You can follow us anywhere on social media at Diagnosing a Killer, with the exception of X, which is at Killer Diagnosis. You can send us an email if you have a request for a case or just want to chat. That is diagnosingakiller@gmail.com. You can also just DM us on Instagram if that's easier. And then we do have a Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, all those good things if you want to support us monetarily. Again, all at Diagnosing a Killer. And last but not least, we have a lovely Patreon community that is patreon.com/diagnosingakiller. We do have 4 tiers on that Patreon. Tier 1 is going to get ad-free mental breakdowns. Tiers 2, 3, and 4 will get ad-free every episode. And then last but not least, tiers 3 and 4 will get an additional bonus episode at the end of each month. That is no content warning, just particularly crazy case. And if you would like to join the folks that have, I think, 11 bonus episodes available right now, you can go to patreon.com/diagnosingakiller. It takes a couple minutes to sign up, and it really makes a difference in our show.
Yeah.
Ooh, I sounded profesh.
You did. You're okay. So profesh right now.
It's been a while since we recorded, so I feel like we're both kind of trying to get back into the flow of things.
Alrighty. Today, we are going to be talking about Charlie Wilkinson and Aaron Caffey.
Charlie Wilkinson and Aaron Caffey. I don't think I know this one.
All right. It's a Texas case, y'all.
Oh, God. Oh, one more thing before we begin. If you're new here, or we've only said this once or twice now, but we are going to be recording the content warning at the end of the episode so as not to spoil the content for each other. It won't sound any different to you guys, but it's a more genuine approach to it instead of just hearing something in the content warning and then you're not expecting anything else.
You didn't say anything about Jake the dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Content warning. This episode contains family troubles, control in relationships, brutal murder, and threats of suicide. If this episode is not for you, we encourage you to check out another one of our episodes. Remember that your mental health comes first, and we love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye. Aaron Caffey was born July 27th, 1991 in Raines County, Texas, in the small town of Celeste, which is about an hour's long drive away of, like, East Dallas, just to kind of orient everyone. Aaron's parents, Terry and Penny Caffey, were elated to welcome their firstborn, and soon Aaron would have a baby brother. In fact, she would be the eldest of 3 children. Her brother Matthew was nicknamed Bubba and was born when Aaron was just 3, and her youngest brother, Tyler, was born when Aaron was 6.
Bubba's cute.
The family was raised in a religious household, and the family as a whole attended Miracle Faith Baptist Church in nearby Emory, Texas. Aaron was known for being very active in the youth activities in the family's church and for her beautiful singing voice in the children's choir. It was said by other participants of the church that Aaron actually was able to encourage other young people to join the youth ministry, as Aaron was such a passionate member of the church, and it seemed to kind of, like, rub off on others. Bro, what?
So sorry. I thought you were done. That was, like, kind of me. Not like, oh, I was so perfect and great, but I was really into the youth group at church when I was, like, in middle school, and I would always bring my friends from school after school, because it was on Wednesday nights, and I would always say, oh, can I bring a friend? And I always wanted them to come because I thought it was, like, the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And then I grew up. I was like, they grew up. Yeah. No, it was a really cool, like activity at the end of the day. I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, I think, I think all 3 of us, whenever we would do, like, church things, we used to do church retreats and stuff, and we went all the way up to Colorado once. Like,
really?
Yeah. I don't remember if I brought any friends. I had a friend that went with me at a few of those, but yeah. The whole family would attend weekly Bible studies on Wednesday nights, not just attending church on Sundays. Often the family would use the gospel room in order to play music as a family. Penny would play piano, Bubba would play guitar or a harmonica, and Aaron would sing. Sometimes Terry would act as a stand-in pastor, and in most of the congregation's eyes, the Caffeys were perfect.
I was going to say, where's the poop?
Where's the poop? The children were enrolled in public school. Bum, bum, bum.
There's the poop. Don't go to public school, y'all.
Don't do it. The children were enrolled in public school most of their lives, but Aaron, at an early age, would struggle with some tasks at school and would eventually be diagnosed with ADD, or attention deficit disorder. By the time Aaron was in middle school, she had already begun to fall behind in her grades. Penny and Terry would begin to discuss homeschooling the kids, as they felt that the more immediate attention at home would benefit Aaron in her schooling, given her disorder.
That makes sense. And also, not that this is correlating in this story specifically, but a lot of the people that I was in the youth group with at church were homeschooled as well. I guess it's, I don't know where that comes from, but...
Yeah. Well, I think for some, it's about the what you're able to teach your child, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Erin would begin to tell her parents about a girl at school who had seemingly had a crush on her.
Ooh.
This was over some time, but nothing at this moment seemed to be specifically affecting Aaron. That is, until the final straw came.
Dun, dun, dun.
Aaron told her parents that the girl that had had a crush on her, in fact, kissed her against her will.
No.
Scandalous. Immediately, Penny and Terry pulled Aaron out of school, and would also pull her younger brothers out of school as well.
Was it noted how the parents felt about it? Were they, like, absolutely not? Like, they don't want Aaron to, like... become a lesbian? Or
yeah.
They were just like, we don't want her to be assaulted, because that's exactly what happened.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but I really do believe that it was just, this is just too much for, like, our innocent Aaron to go through.
We don't do that.
Yeah, and I think that they very much felt that she would have been corrupted or something by this experience.
Aren't we all in public school?
Not kissing girls.
No,
that's
yeah.
That's different.
Corrupted, I mean.
Furthermore, the family would pack up and leave the small town of Celeste and move to Alba, Texas, an even smaller Texas town.
Ooh.
The family told friends and family that the move was purposeful and that it was to move closer to the family church, shaving the family's driving time by about 40 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So they were traveling to go to this church.
Okay.
But now it's like, okay, it's like more of like a 15-minute drive, not a 40-minute drive.
So they're probably there more often.
Yeah, no. Sure. So this was seen as understandable. And just to give everyone an idea of just how small of a town this is, the population difference between Celeste and Alba is about 2/3. Celeste is sitting at about 840 for the population, and Alba is sitting at about 490. So it's even smaller. 490 people.
Jeez.
Very small.
Yeah.
Penny would now be the one to provide the schooling for the three children, and this was to be a faith-based curriculum, which is what they call it. I couldn't remember, like, 2 seconds ago what they called it, but they call it faith-based curriculum.
Got it.
No evolution. Considering that Aaron was a social person and she was of age about 15 or 16, Aaron was allowed and also encouraged to get a part-time job. Huh. Seeing as the family only had one income at this time, her parents were pretty supportive of this.
Guess where my part-time job was when I was 15 and 16?
Where?
The church.
Oh.
So I swear. I was working at the nursery in the church.
I worked for a pizza place, which was great because at the time I was really into smoking a lot of weed, and I got free pizza all the time.
Oh, yeah. No, we got pizza all the time. Loved yeah. it.
Aaron decided then to work at the local Sonic, as many other young people in the area did as well.
Hell yeah.
And also that, yeah, it's just... part of their demographic was like, hang out at the local Sonic. One of her coworkers said that meeting Aaron, it almost seemed like she was exploring the world for the first time. Despite this, Aaron was eventually the most well-known car hop at work. For those who do not know what a Sonic drive-in is, here in the States, Sonic drive-in is a fast food establishment known for its drive-in accessibility. You essentially drive into a parking spot and there are menus by every car door. You press the menu's big red button and you order your food, a massive Route 44 drink, which are all customizable, like peach Dr. Peppers or crazy banana mango shakes or something.
I read somewhere that there's like thousands of combinations you can make.
That's their whole thing, is like thousands of combinations. My favorite was always just a classic ocean water.
Same! I was going to say that.
Ocean water with like...
It's a coconut Sprite. Yeah. That's essentially what it is, and it's blue.
Yeah, a blue coconut Sprite. It's so good.
Oh, and the cherry limeade slush. Strawberry limeade slush.
They're known for their cherry limeades.
Sponsor us.
Back in the day, all attendants working as a car hop would be required to use roller skates and deliver your food directly to your car.
I didn't know they were required at first.
They were. That was part of the job. But as it became a safety hazard over the years, most locations did away with this requirement. However, in some locations, if you sign a waiver, it is completely legal for you to roller skate if you so choose.
I heard that you got paid more if you were on roller skates. Is that true?
I think you just get tipped more. That's true, right?
Yeah, but I thought it was like a different hour. Like if they were like, if you were like willing to be on roller skates, we'll pay you like 10 cents more an hour.
I'm pretty sure they only get minimum wage working at Sonic, but that was kind of the crux of it because they weren't getting server pay and then accepting for tip culture, you know, countries like us.
I thought they would get server pay and then rely on tips similar to like a waitress in a restaurant.
No, but that's the thing is that it came out that they were actually getting minimum wage and then people stopped tipping them.
I was like, fuck you then.
Aaron quickly became the most popular worker at this location, and it was essentially unheard of for car hops to still use skates, but she did.
Nice.
She would make quite a few regulars out of some of her patrons. She loved coming to work because she had an opportunity just to be a teenager. Mm-hmm. It was here at the Sonic where she would meet the young man who would change her life in the course of forever, ever, never. Charlie Wilkinson.
Okay.
Charlie Wilkinson was the only child between his biological mother and biological father, although Charlie would come to have a stepbrother, a stepsister, and a half-sister eventually. His mother and father divorced when Charlie was very young, and his mother would eventually move across Texas to Del Rio. After this, she rarely saw Charlie, sometimes only seeing him two times a year. Charlie lived with his dad, who worked at a paper mill closer to the major city of Dallas, Texas. Charlie did fine in school, but not great. He did, however, love participating in the school's Texas National Guard, or it's something like JRTC, or for those who don't know, Joint Readiness Training, which is kind of like military training for high school kids. Heading into his senior year, Charlie attended boot camp in Fort Sill in Oklahoma, just a few hours north of Dallas, and he had aspirations of heading into the military after graduation. Having just returned to town after boot camp training, he would meet Aaron while driving through the local Sonic. Charlie was 17, soon to be 18 at this time. He was known by locals to drive a beat-up truck and often wore cut-off t-shirts, stained jeans, and boots.
I can just see him.
I know, right? I can smell him. He also went by the online handle Hillbilly on the latest social media accounts. AKA That's MySpace, because this is
so original.
So original. Yeah, it's me to hear, baby. He and a few of his friends were known to shoot guns in the woods, hunt, and also fish in the area. And although Charlie didn't have any issues at this time with authority, as in, like, he wasn't necessarily a troublemaker, his classmates would sometimes push Charlie into anger, and essentially, he was known to get very angry when agitated or provoked.
Okay.
And they thought it was funny.
Oh, hilarious, yeah.
It's hilarious, yeah.
Just pushes fucking buttons.
Pushes buttons, and sometimes Charlie would slam things into walls, like chairs or books, or bang his fist on tables out of fits of frustration.
God, that sucks.
Just like, it's just always on the surface, right? Yeah. Other than that, no major huge outbursts or signs of violence. After Aaron and Charlie met at Sonic, Aaron and Charlie started seeing each other almost every day. They would spend hours with each other while Aaron would be at work, as it was basically the only time that they could hang out with each other.
Yeah, because it's not weird if a teenage kid hangs out at Sonic all day, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron knew that her parents would not approve of her seeing anyone, let alone a boy that was a few years older than her. And especially someone like Charlie. I mean, the dude goes by Hillbilly.
Oh, he's a hillbilly.
Hillbilly. Get that hillbilly boy out of here. That's terrible. It reminded me of, I was telling the story to Cliff the other day about old high school friend of mine who was really, really drunk. And I just remember dad caught us walking through the neighborhood, and he pulls up in the truck and he goes, "Get in the truck. That boy's drunk." It was so funny.
And I was like, dad has the farthest thing from like a Southern accent.
I know. It was just so, forceful, you know, like it was funny. Erin would eventually approach her parents about seeing Charlie, even if it was nothing more than keeping Charlie from her parents. Like, essentially, like, Erin's such a good kid, she just couldn't keep it from her parents. Mm-hmm. She's like, "Oh, well, me and this boy have been spending some time together." She essentially just couldn't lie about her, like, to her parents about it. Although Erin's parents were immediately wary of their only daughter seeing an older boy, they felt that if they were to completely block her off from seeing Charlie, that she would continue to do so anyways.
Yeah.
So in order to keep a watchful eye on Erin, the couple agreed to allow Charlie in their home on occasion, as long as Erin's parents were also there in the home to watch the two.
I mean, that's the best you can do in that situation. You can't, like, if they're right, if you say, "I forbade you from seeing this boy," then it's like, she's going to just do it in secret. And then she's going to start lying about stuff, and then that could escalate very quickly. But also, you can't be like, "Oh yeah, we love this guy, bring him over all the time," you know, because then that could escalate.
Marry him. Right. Yeah. Often, Charlie would come around the family home, sometimes to help Erin's brothers build bonfires in the backyard, or to just help around the house. But most often, the family would have sit-down dinners. Quickly, however, it was noticed by Erin's parents that Charlie almost always walked into the home very nonchalantly. He would regularly plop down on the family couch, making himself at home, putting his feet on the family furniture, or draping his legs over the arm of the couch.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. I'd be like, "Get this no good here, here." Regardless of the uncomfortable nature of Charlie's behavior, Erin's parents did not stop their daughter from having Charlie over some nights of the week. The one rule, however, was that was to remain in place strictly, was that Charlie was not to be over after 9 p.m.
Okay.
Sure, Charlie would head home after 9 p.m., but Erin and Charlie would talk on the phone until all hours of the night. This would be in opposition of Erin's phone curfew. And although it looks like this is kind of a slippery slope for Erin and Charlie, Charlie actually began attending church with Erin. After all, it wasn't uncommon for Erin to share her faith with others and eventually inspire others to join the church as well. And this was also recognized by Erin's parents, that maybe they were finally warming up to Charlie just a little bit. Mm-hmm. At least he's willing to go to church with them.
Yeah.
Shortly after Charlie began attending the family's church, Erin would approach her parents about returning to public school. It had been some time since her and her brothers had been homeschooled, and if she and her brothers were able to attend public school, Penny, Erin's mom, would finally be able to work again.
She's like, "I'm doing this for you, Mom.
I'm doing this for you, Mom." The couple would agree, and halfway through the school year of 2007, leading into 2008, Erin would begin attending the local public high school.
And how old is she around this point?
16. Erin, a freshman, and Charlie, a senior, would often be seen in between classes, holding hands, and overall expressing PDA.
He was a senior.
This is also public displays of affection for people that don't know what PDA stands for. This may have been unacceptable in Erin's family home, but this was nothing new to the eyes of public school. She was feeling more and more free to express her and Charlie's relationship as time went on. Erin's parents also agreed to allow Charlie and Erin to go out on a few dates alone, with the understanding that Erin would be home by a certain time. Well, wouldn't you know, what do you think kids do when they go out on dates?
They don't show up on time.
Well, they sleep together. Oh. So, sometime after Erin and Charlie had sex for the first time, Charlie would give Erin a promise ring, saying that he intended to be with Erin forever.
Bullshit.
Right? It's hilarious. Erin was elated, but when she broke the news to her parents, they were less than enthused. Erin's parents promptly told Erin that she was to return the ring, as they believed that the ring represented Charlie essentially claiming Erin.
Okay, that's
They did dry. Not like that. They disagreed with it. They did not like it, insisting that this meant that she was taken by Charlie and it was more of a statement of ownership. They just didn't like him. They didn't think that it was okay for Erin to just promise herself to this older boy who doesn't have his shit together, you know. Yeah. I mean, he's also a kid, so. Again, Aaron was just 16 at the time, and Aaron's parents told Aaron that her time with Charlie was, like, essentially to be limited again. Like, they were like, we don't want you to see him as much, even though they're barely seeing each other.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie would only now be allowed to come over once a week. Aaron confided in friends and other members of her family that she was planning to run away once she turned 17. Which, not a lot of people know this, that you are a legal adult at the age of 17 in the state of Texas.
Yes.
I was able to sign a lease.
That's crazy.
I know. At 17, I was able to sign a lease. That was, like, my really bad, terrible ex, too. So I was really grateful when we broke the lease because I legally wasn't responsible for it. He was. LOL, peace. Tensions in the house continued to rise, and in one argument, Penny actually got so frustrated with Aaron that she slapped her daughter.
Not very Christian of you, Penny.
Not very Christian of you, Penny. Aaron continued to see Charlie at work and school, and he was sometimes allowed to come over. However, she continued to break her phone curfew. When she would be caught, Aaron would incur more restrictions. First, she lost the ability to use her own car, then her phone, and she was to ride with her parents to and from school every day, which is probably, like, the worst thing ever.
Yeah,
like...
and work, too.
And work, yeah, absolutely. Like, they would just want to make sure she wasn't going to run away. I mean, she had already told family members she was running away.
Yeah.
Eventually, Aaron's parents would revoke all of Charlie's visits to the house. Aaron and Charlie would begin to confide in friends that they were incredibly unhappy with the situation developing between them and Aaron's parents. They considered themselves to be star-crossed lovers and began to plot to not just run away together, but maybe even if Aaron got pregnant, her parents would have to agree to them eventually getting married.
And if they don't, we'll just kill them. Born and brewed in Southern California since 1963, the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf has always been passionate about connecting loyal customers with carefully handcrafted products. Their coffee master, Jay Isaias, only selects the top 1% of Arabica beans from the world's best-growing regions, giving customers the best quality product every time. Whether you're looking for a dark roast to liven up your day, or a soothing tea to relax into the night, the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf has it all. Click the link in our show notes today to access an exclusive offer and get sipping.
However, the conversations would quickly turn to plans of murder.
Oh, shit.
Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, we saw that one coming, but I didn't realize it was the next sentence.
For the entire month of February, the couple told friends of their intention to kill Aaron's parents.
They told people for a whole month and no one said a thing.
They were to take all of the valuables in the home and flee the area together. Friends would agree that at this time, it was likely all talk. But when Penny headed down to the local library, she did something that we all take for granted nowadays, since we have such an ease of access for things. She essentially Googled, and then I put in parentheses, Ask Jeeves. Do you remember Ask Jeeves?
I do remember Ask Jeeves. I finally got one of your references.
Pre-Google. So, yes, Penny, the mom, Aaron's mom, she went down to the local library and she essentially Googled or asked Jeeves Charlie Wilkinson. So, like, she was like, I'm gonna look this dude up.
Okay.
See what he's about, see what his family's about, all this shit.
And he's just wicked famous and he's gonna be all over the internet, right?
Yeah, by the handle Hillbilly, though, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so she asked Jeeves Charlie Wilkinson and came across his social media page or his MySpace. The page contained shared content and posts that made Penny uncomfortable. Charlie would share pictures or memes, I guess. They weren't memes at the time, but pictures, yeah. Right? That were related to sex and drugs. And some posts that seemed to describe him having sex with Aaron. Like, he was like,
no.
Yeah, I got that tonight.
She, like, clutches her pearls.
She clutched her pearls. She gasped. That was it. Penny and Terry had had enough. They forbid Aaron from seeing Charlie any longer. But the reaction that they received, they didn't expect. In a shocking turn of the conversation about the breakup, Aaron began to break down and cry. She stated that she had in fact wanted to break up with Charlie and that things were just getting too intense for her. She felt like she was being controlled by Charlie at this point of their relationship and that his behavior had become concerning and erratic. She knew that he wasn't good for her. Erin and her parents had never had a troubled relationship before between the three of them, and with Charlie, it was kind of like he was the common thread. Like,
yeah.
This whole thing is the reason that they're not getting along.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being handed the excuse to break up with Charlie by blaming her parents, Erin agreed that she would break up with Charlie. March 1st, 2008.
Oh, shit.
In the early morning hours, Tommy Gaston, an elderly neighbor of the Caffeys, would be shocked to find a bloodied man crawling through his property towards his house.
I'm sorry.
Tommy rushed over to the man, quickly realizing that it was Terry Caffey.
No.
He had been shot 5 times, in his shoulder, his back, and once in his head.
Oh my God.
Tommy immediately called 911 as he attempted to render aid to 41-year-old Terry Caffey.
I just pictured, like, we live in a cul-de-sac. I just pictured, like, any one of our neighbors in, like, that same state. And I'm like, oh my God, how fucking scary.
That's terrifying. Police would soon arrive, and when they approached Terry asking what happened to him, Terry said, quote, "They're all gone. Charlie Wilkinson shot my family," end quote.
What? Hold the phone.
Terry had crawled 500 yards from the Caffey home, so naturally, the police went to the Caffey's home to secure the scene. When the police arrived at the Caffey's, they immediately noticed smoke and flames coming from the home. Firefighters fought the blaze through the day and eventually night fell, but unfortunately so would the home.
Oh my God.
It was completely reduced to the foundation. Within the home was the remains of Penny, 13-year-old Bubba, and 8-year-old Tyler.
Oh my God.
Meanwhile, mere hours after Terry told police that Charlie Wilkinson was the perpetrator of this crime, police were able to ask around and locate Charlie. He was reportedly staying at a friend's house. Police busted in and found Charlie passed out on a mattress, lying next to a firearm.
Sorry, just passes out with the murder weapon. Blocks away.
It wasn't me. You have no proof. Ugh. Yes, he was laying next to this firearm. Thankfully, he was taken into custody without incident. He's lucky he didn't get shot. When police asked where he was all night, Charlie claimed that he had no recollection of the night before. I got drunk, bro.
Convenient.
I conveniently got drunk, bro. Yeah. He insisted that he stayed with his friends all night long partying. After Charlie was removed from the friend's house, a search warrant was issued in order to continue to search the property. There, at his friend's house, cowering in a closet, was a crying, disheveled Erin Caffey. Erin also claimed that she had no recollection of what transpired over the last few hours, even claiming that she had no idea where she even was.
Huh. A likely story.
A likely story. Police were convinced that Erin was the victim of a kidnapping, after Charlie had just killed her entire family. Now in a hospital room, Erin told police what she did remember. She remembered waking up to smoke engulfing her room. She remembered seeing 2 men standing in front of her, holding swords, dressed in all black.
It's always 2 men.
It's always two men
in the made-up stories.
Mm-hmm. She remembers attempting to call her friend, Charlie. She remembers being ordered on the ground by these men and being forced to then drink something. Her next memory is being at Charlie's friend's house, although it was like she was like, I was just at that house. I'm saying Charlie's friend's house. She didn't say that. She further stated that she believed that these individuals were still after her. Investigators recalled that Erin didn't even smell like smoke, which kind of didn't support their belief that she was, like, an actual victim.
Yeah, if anyone's ever been, God forbid, near a house fire or even a bonfire,
mm-hmm.
that shit sticks in your hair for, like, days.
Yeah.
You know?
And especially when she was like, I woke up and I was engulfed in smoke.
Yeah, that wouldn't check.
Police were not present when it was revealed to Erin that her father had in fact survived the attack, which is a regret the police would eventually have. Charlie was in custody when he was told that Terry Caffey had survived the attack. And although he didn't immediately admit that he was the attacker, he did admit that Aaron was in fact involved with the attack and the one who orchestrated the murders.
So why would the father say that he... Okay, go ahead.
What?
Why is the dad saying it's Charlie? Is he trying to cover for his daughter, or is she just the mastermind? You know what I mean? Go ahead.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
the listeners know what I'm talking about.
Charlie had employed a friend's brother, Charles Wade, to help kill the Caffeys. He promised Charles Wade $2,000 to help him. He's like, Aaron says there's a lot of money in this house, so we're going to kill the parents.
Yeah.
We're going to take the money, and I'm going to pay you $2,000 to help me do it.
The guy was like, worth it?
He's like, oh, yeah, you bet. Of course, they couldn't use Charlie's truck, since it was well-known by the family and the neighbors. So they then asked another senior named Bobby Johnson to give the three a ride around that night.
Bobby Johnson.
She's a Bobby Johnson.
Bobby Johnson.
Bobby would eventually be questioned, and she claimed she had no knowledge prior to this that this was the intention of Charles and Charlie. Charles and Charge. Bobby, Charlie, and Charles went to the Caffey's home around 1:30 a.m., picked up Aaron, and drove around a while they came up with a plan. So at this point, Bobby knows. When asked why he agreed to kill Aaron's parents in the first place, Charlie said, quote, I ain't got no conscience. I joined the army to do whatever needed to be done without thinking, end quote. And, quote, I intended to kill them because I thought I was in love, end quote.
You're so deep, bro.
Yeah, you're so deep.
I ain't got no conscience, but I'm in love.
That's essentially what he said.
I ain't got no conscience. Your love put me in unconsciousness. I don't know. I don't rap.
Just drunk on love. Aaron and Bobby stayed in the car while the boys walked inside. Charlie was to kill her parents, but Charles was to kill her brothers, as Charlie claimed that it would be too hard for him to kill Bubba and Tyler.
Oh, okay, yeah. It's way too hard for me to do. I don't have a conscience.
I ain't got no conscience. I'm Peter Panky. Charlie snuck into the house and made his way upstairs. He first attempted to shoot Terry and Penny. However, the gun jammed. Charles was then able to take the gun and fix it and then handed it back to Charlie.
Okay.
Right? Charlie then shot Terry and Penny several times. And although he believed Terry had died immediately, Penny was still noticeably alive. Charlie then retrieved a kitchen knife and slit Penny's throat, killing her.
Oh my fucking god.
Bubba and Tyler, Aaron's brothers, aged 13 and 8, were awoken by the gunshots. When they entered the hallway to see what had transpired, they were in shock that Charlie and another unknown boy were the cause of the noise. They both rushed into Aaron's room, which had a lock on the inside of the door, and the boys were able to lock themselves inside.
Aww.
Charles and Charlie agreed that they could not leave without the boys, without them killing the boys, since they had already seen them. Charlie stood on the other side of the door, pleading with the boys to come out of Aaron's room.
Oh my god.
Ensuring them that he and Charles would not hurt them.
Oh my god, that's so sad.
However, this was a lie. The boys would eventually open the door, trusting Charlie, and when Charlie and Charles attempted to grab them, they were essentially fighting, trying to flee. Charles would fire a single shot, killing Bubba instantly, before stabbing 8-year-old Tyler to death with the same knife used to kill his own mother. Charlie had grabbed a bag that was previously packed by Aaron, and the two would head back to the car. Charles and Charlie then returned to the home, opened the lockbox that Aaron claimed was full of money. However, with this and whatever was in Terry and Penny's wallet and purse, the total cash taken was a measly $375.
Fucking worth it, huh?
They're idiots. They're children.
Charles is like, half that's mine, you know.
Yeah. You owe me $2,000. How much more do you owe me?
Yeah.
Ugh. When getting back into the car, Charlie recalls Aaron saying, quote, I'm glad that's over, end quote.
Oh, what a monster.
She's...
I'm genuine. I'm not trying to be silly. Oh my god.
After driving around for some time, the four reached a friend's house where Charlie and Aaron would have sex before falling asleep.
I
Which is so gross.
That's so fucking gross.
Like, I think of Gypsy Rose.
I was just going to say, calm down, Gypsy Rose.
Yeah, Gypsy Rose and Nick Godijon, for sure. Meanwhile, while Charlie is in the interrogation room, Erin's toxicology reports come back from the hospital. She was negative for any sedatives or any potentially harmful substances that would cause memory loss. Erin. Erin, Charlie, Bobby, and Charles would all be arrested within 24 hours of the murders of Penny, Bubba, and Tyler Caffey, and the attempted murder of Terry. Terry would stay in the hospital for just days before being released, sustaining only a broken nose, fractured cheekbones, and minor nerve damage.
Wow, that's incredible. I was going to say crazy.
Terry told Pamela Colliff of Texas Monthly, quote, "I remember the nurse coming in and saying, 'Mr. Caffey, you can go home now.' And all I heard was the word home. I thought, I don't have a home. I don't have a family to go to. And I remember weeping, just weeping uncontrollably. I laid on my sister's couch for a few days, and that's when the despair hit me. I decided that I was going to go back to my property and end my life. I was going to lay down and shoot myself right there on the spot where I lost my family. I wanted to die where they died. And then I decided, no, there's been enough bloodshed. I'm going to take all the pain pills they gave me. All the depression medication, the Xanax, everything. Drink me a bottle of Jim Beam, put a hose in the tailpipe of my daughter's pickup, run it through a window, and just fall asleep and not wake up again. So 2 or 3 days I pondered this, and somebody brought me a Bible and told me to read the book of Job. Well, I read the story countless times before, but when I read it again, it was almost like I was there with Job. He'd lost everything, his whole family, all his worldly possessions, but he did not lose his faith. And God blessed him doubly. That turned me around, and it got me thinking that God might have a plan for me. He didn't bring me through all of that for nothing. I went back to our property as soon as I was better. There was nothing left but the subfloor and the metal roof. I spent days out there picking through the ashes. I would get on my hands and knees and just dig. I didn't find much. A Hot Wheels car, a broken ceramic cup, a horseshoe-shaped belt buckle that the kids had given me for Christmas. I ended up buying a used RV, and I moved it back on my land. Everyone said I was crazy for going back, but it brought me healing. I put my RV right on the spot where my house once stood, and I stayed there for about 4 months. I was so stubborn, I thought, I'll be darned if someone's going to run me off our property. When I leave, it'll be when I'm ready and when God's ready for me to leave. Some nights it was pitch black by the time I got home, and I had to work up the courage to get out of my car. I brought a 9mm pistol with me when I slept." End quote.
Damn.
Terry would visit his daughter in jail twice a week leading up to her trial. Terry would often keep the topics light, but once he started to process what had happened, he began to ask Erin several times if he was too harsh on her, if he and Penny were good parents, overall looking for a reason for the crime. But Terry never seemed to get a direct answer. Erin would be tried as an adult, given the severity of the crime. Her phone records showed that Erin called Charlie several times on the night of the crime, proving that she had every intention of not allowing Charlie to back out of the plan that she concocted. Oh my God. Of course, capital punishment in the state of Texas for first-degree murder is the penalty of death. When discussing this topic in a letter to the Raines County DA, Terry Caffey said, quote, "My heart tells me that there has been enough deaths. I want them, in this lifetime, to have a chance for remorse and to come to a place of repentance for what they have done. Killing them will not bring my family back," end quote.
What a fucking guy.
Straight up. Bobby Johnson would plead guilty to being an accomplice to the crime, and would ultimately be sentenced to 40 years in prison.
Whoa.
Yeah, straight up.
Damn, I'd be fucking this is pissed.
Texas, girl.
Like, Texas. You motherfuckers took me to this fucking crime scene, and now I'm in jail for the rest of my life.
The thing is, though, is that they drove around for almost an hour while they were discussing what they're doing. True, it's not. She could have been like, get the fuck out of my car. What are you talking about?
But maybe they were like, we're going to fucking kill you then. Take your fucking car.
I guess so.
I don't know. Probably not.
Charles Wade and Charlie Wilkinson would be sentenced to life in prison without parole after pleading guilty to 3 counts of murder. So they were like, we'll plead so you don't kill us, essentially.
Pussies.
Erin pleaded guilty to 2 counts of first-degree murder, for the minimum of 42 years to be served and will be eligible for parole when she's 60.
Wow.
Terry continues to be in his daughter's corner. He was even seen holding hands with her throughout her trial. Terry says about his daughter, quote, "I think that she thought that Charlie was just blowing smoke. I don't think that she actually thought he would go through with it. I know my daughter. She cried one time when we were in my truck and I ran over a squirrel. She's tender-hearted. No kid's an angel, but I know what she's capable of, and I know she's not capable of murder," end quote.
But, I mean, he's a better man than I am, right? Because I couldn't fucking do that. But you also have to look at the facts. Like, she was involved, you know what I mean? Like, she could do that because she did do it, you know?
A lot of Bobby Johnson's testimony was about how Erin acted, what she said and did before the crimes and after the crimes. And even Bobby Johnson was like, she's a cold-blooded bitch. Like, she was straight up, had this indifference about what was occurring. And then when it happened, she was like, oh my God, I just, like, can't wait to get out of here. Like, I can't wait to be with Charlie. Yeah.
God.
Like, she was just so, like, she didn't fully get what was going on.
It could have been a folly to do situation, though, her spending so much time with Charlie and him putting it into her head.
Yeah.
That, like, that's the only way they can be together. It might have been, you know.
Another bit of Bobby Johnson's testimony was that Charlie had asked several times, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure?
And she's like, yep.
Yep.
Oh, my God, that's terrible.
Terry still visits his daughter and is now remarried. He has adopted his wife's 3 children and even had another child of his own.
Oh, that makes me happy.
He became a pastor and tells his story in hopes of inspiring others to seek forgiveness within their own lives.
Oh my God, what a fucking guy. I love this guy.
Erin Caffey is now 33 years old and is currently residing in an undisclosed Texas prison.
Huntsville.
Yeah, down there at Dilly.
Hillbilly Dilly.
Besides Erin's ADD, we haven't clearly spoken of a mental diagnosis surrounding this case. But according to an article by PopSugar.com, Dr. Leela R. Magavi, MD, who is a Hopkins-trained psychiatrist and is the regional medical director for... God damn it.
Whoa. Does she say that every time she introduces herself to someone?
She's like, it's me, Hopkins-trained psychiatrist and regional medical director for community psychiatry in California. That's what she says.
Beautiful. We're leaving that.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
She said about overprotective children that, quote, "Over-sheltered children are restrained from exploring and understanding the external world freely due to parents' anxiety and apprehension.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get there. She goes on to say, quote, "Children tend to have difficulty making decisions or speaking for themselves when they are too sheltered. They may exhibit anxiety and self-esteem concerns.
Mm-hmm.
They may struggle with remaining independent and may additionally have difficulty handling rejection and failure. They also may be less imaginative and creative," end quote.
Well, when you don't have a lot of those decisions to make on your own as a child, like, how do you make any of those decisions as an adult?
Yeah.
And then that leads to someone like Erin, who is very clearly a follower of someone that's capable of murder.
Yes.
Even if it was her plan, you know, she's willing to go along with it because she hasn't really made decisions like that outside of ever, you know?
I agree. I think that it's very much that her parents made her decisions. God too, you know? I mean, that's also a thing, is that God has this plan for her. She doesn't have to do any of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? God also gave you free will, but,
true.
You know, that's just must be the way that she saw it. Plus, she was so young.
Yeah, and really, really influential at that age.
I think so, too.
Charlie, I mean, I don't know what's going on with him, but he definitely has some sort of maybe personality disorder.
And probably oppositional defiance.
That too, yeah.
Just given the fact that he wanted to go into the military so young, that was something that he felt like he could be successful at because he probably really required that structure. And unlike Erin, he had no structure probably. You know, he was able to run about town and do whatever he wanted to do and, you know, would have essentially no one looking over him. So it's kind of opposites attract at that point.
It kind of seems like he also kind of has this underlying sense of, like, need for control, almost. I'm not exactly sure where that would come from, but...
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, maybe, yeah, it is the kind of the opposite. Is like, maybe he lacked control, so he created control by controlling someone else.
That's true, yeah.
And Erin was easily controlled because of the situation she was already in.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, the whole thing is that she didn't want to be controlled by her parents, but she let Charlie control her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that she's not responsible for this.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that, you know, like you mentioned, folie à deux type situation. It's they both want what the other has and has provided that by each other. And it just gets so crazy out of control that they don't understand the gravity or the severity mm-hmm. of what they're experiencing. Or
oh, she probably didn't understand the true consequences of any of that because she probably wasn't allowed to experience media that was like that or whatever, yeah. you know, in the household. But you're right, like, they're so young and, like, you know, this is teenage kids and they're in love or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. We've seen it before. Other people that are, they're so in love, they're willing to kill for it. Like,
yeah, like Romeo and Juliet. And,
yeah, Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck. Like, Martha wanted right. that affection so badly that she was willing to turn the other cheek when Raymond killed someone in front of her, and she was willing to do it herself as well.
Yeah.
We see it a lot, and it's mm-hmm. unfortunate.
Yeah.
No one that loves you will make you kill people, just saying.
It's so true. People that really, truly love you care about your mental health.
Right.
They exactly. care about you, and they want you to take care of yourself as much as they want to take care of you. So.
Yes.
Yes. So that is Charlie Wilkinson and Erin Caffey.
God, good case. Ugh. I've never heard that story at all, but it's yeah. it's very interesting always. I mean, it's so tragic, but mm-hmm. it's a very interesting case because it doesn't happen very often when it's a full, almost full family. What is it called? A familicide?
Almost a familicide, yeah. Well, yeah. it's a familicide is usually when a family member is the perpetrator, like a Joel Guy Jr.
I still think she is the perpetrator, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess so, right? Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for joining us for another case.
Yes, thank you to Vince for recommending that one.
Yeah, absolutely. We will definitely get this out there for you guys to listen to. Our Patreon members will have this one ad-free. And then, dun-dun-dun, should I say what we're not who I'm doing, but what we're doing?
Yes.
Okay. Here's our plan, y'all. I'm going out of town for 2 weeks, but the case that I am doing is a fucking doozy. It is not even small enough to be a two-parter, so it's going to have to be a three-parter. So be looking forward to a three-part case coming out over the next 3 weeks. Yes, you heard me right. We are going to make you wait in anticipation a week for each part, but it's going to be so worth it, y'all. It's going to be really, really intense. And of course, we'll have mental breakdowns each week as well.
Yes.
But yeah.
I'm so excited. I'm excited to just listen to you.
Oh my God.
It's going to be great.
60 pages.
Oh my God. Okay.
And with that, we will see you guys on Monday with another mental breakdown.
Yes.
All right.
Love you. Bye. Rifle Paper Company is known for their high-quality, handmade designs that are sure to brighten and lighten up every room in your home. Rifle Paper has been creating one-of-a-kind designs since 2009. From stationery to decor, find your favorite design and shop from there. My favorite design is Bramble. I can get this design in duvets, tumblers, an ottoman, and even wallpaper. Nathan and Anna Bond are a husband and wife team, and they are the brilliant minds behind Rifle Paper Company, which is fueled by local Florida printers. Click the link in the show notes to receive an exclusive offer today. Rifle Paper Company, quality products that bring beauty into the everyday.